From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, movie theater owners and film studios are in Las Vegas for the annual industry pep rally known as CinemaCon. And then Mary Kay Place arrived in L.A. in the 1970s to act, but she also wrote for classic TV shows like MASH and The Mary Tyler Moore Show. And it all began with a job as an assistant.
I typed about 940,000 versions of various scripts, and I thought, wait a minute, I've got some ideas for shows like that.
Then, the singer for L.A. noise pop trio Cherry Glazer wants to smash gender bias with her music. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in today for John Horn, who's in Las Vegas for a few days attending CinemaCon. And here he is. Hi, John.
Hey, Steve.
So, John, you're at this thing called CinemaCon. I tend to think of it as kind of a pep rally for movie theaters and Hollywood studios. How would you characterize it?
I think that's a good choice of words. I mean, it is the annual gathering of everybody who owns a movie theater. And a lot of those people are chains, but there are also 80 countries from around the world that are represented here. And basically, the movie studios and some independent companies come out and they do a little song and dance where they show clips from upcoming movies. There's a couple of screenings of completed films. They bring out some actors, maybe some directors. They try to get the theater owners excited about the films that are coming out not only later this summer, but all the way through the fall and to the end of the year. And the theater owners are having their own kind of meetings about where their business is going. So it is a theater owners convention, but it's really about the movie business and about what's going to get people excited and come into the multiplex in the months ahead.
Well, you only arrived in Las Vegas just this morning. Who have you seen speak so far, and what's been the sort of vibe on the convention floor?
Well, there are two speakers who kind of kick things off, and one person is John Fithian. He's the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, and the other one is Charles Rifkin, who represents the Motion Picture Association of America, and that's all the movie studios. So they're slightly different messages. Charles Rifkin is basically saying to the theater owners, and I'm quoting him now, audiences are evolving, so you must adapt quickly to deliver what consumers want. And you can interpret that however you want to interpret that. Fithian, speaking on behalf of the theater owners, is basically saying to the movie studios, don't send your films to streaming services like Netflix. Mm-hmm. Show them in theaters first, because that's how movies get noticed. And if you want to stand out when you get to Netflix or get to Amazon or Hulu, you better play in theaters, because there's so many movies out there, nobody's going to hear of your film unless you show it in theaters first. It's an interesting argument. I think you can look at a film like Bird Box on Netflix that was a huge hit and never got within a mile of a theater as proof that that theory doesn't always work.
Well, what's the incentive for a streaming service like Netflix to acquiesce to the studios and let them have a big film like Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, you know, 90 days in advance of a streaming?
Well, The Irishman is a great example, because I think that's going to be a real referendum on where theater owners and Netflix is going. So it's a Martin Scorsese gangster movie. It's got Al Pacino, it's Jimmy Hoffa, Robert De Niro's in it, Joe Pesci's in it. I mean, it's a classic kind of Scorsese gang drama. Now, this is a movie that Netflix has spent a lot of money on. I think the reported budget I've seen is $175 million. So the question is, will theater owners say, we really want The Irishman, we'll play it for a month, and then it can appear on Netflix, or are they going to blacklist it and not take it at all? That's coming out later this year. It'll be a fascinating referendum on the future of exhibition and really the future of Netflix as a theatrical distributor.
Well, John, this is a decades-long marriage between movie theater chains and the movie studios. Give me an idea of what, you know, the state of this relationship is.
I think the next year or two is going to be really important. And I think when you start looking more closely, it's not just about what's happening with streaming services like Netflix. You have to remember that there's been a huge merger. Disney has bought Fox, so there's now one fewer studio producing content. Disney and Fox now control about 40% of the market in terms of films released. makes sense that they might release fewer films, might make sense that they're going to dictate tougher terms in terms of how much it costs theaters to get their movies because they have so much clout. And also, there are a lot of companies, Universal, Warner Brothers, Disney, their parent companies are starting streaming services. And the theater owners are really going to be asking the question now and over the next couple of years, if you're making some new content, are we going to get it first? Or is it going to go to your streaming service?
Well, John, last week, Variety published this story into how cleaning crews at major movie theater chains get paid and how they're treated on the job. And it really exposed this kind of dark side to the movie theater business. I know you had a chance to look at this piece. How do you think theater chains will address this at CinemaCon, or will they at all?
I think they kind of have to, because I think the story that they have put forward so far is, it was a third-party vendor. We weren't really in charge of the people who were cleaning our theaters. We didn't really know about the working conditions and wage theft and other labor violations. But to me, that's a little bit like going to a restaurant and the chef saying he doesn't know how badly the staff is being taken care of. I think when you go to a movie theater, you want to know that the experience is going to be good and that people aren't being taken advantage of to have a clean theater. And if you walk into a movie theater and you're worried about whether or not the theater is exploiting labor, I think inevitably it's going to take away from the enjoyment of the experience. So they haven't said anything yet. CinemaCon is just now going, but I certainly suspect they'll be addressing it either behind closed doors or in some meetings coming up.
Well, CinemaCon is an opportunity for us to get a little preview of what's coming up for the year. What are some of the most anticipated films?
Well, I think if you start looking at what the big studios are bringing to CinemaCon, you're going to recognize a lot of familiar titles because it's almost all sequels and spinoffs. Disney is going to probably show some footage from Avengers Endgame, the next Avengers movie. They're probably going to present something from Toy Story 4, the live-action version of Lion King, and that trend kind of continues with other studios. Warner Brothers has a new Godzilla remake. They've got an update on Shaft. There's another sequel of Annabelle. Universal has got a sequel to Secret Life of Pets, some sort of Fast and Furious spinoff. When you start looking at the slates, there's not a lot of original material that is going to be highlighted. Paramount, though, has a movie called Rocket Man, which is an Elton John musical from director Dexter Fletcher. You probably have never heard of him, but he's the guy who replaced Bryan Singer when he was fired on Bohemian Rhapsody. So that might be an interesting movie to look for in the next couple of days.
John, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
Coming up on The Frame, Mary Kay Place has starred in dozens of films and TV shows. Now at the age of 71, she's landed her first lead role. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Mary Kay Place is one of those actors who's been in so many movies and TV shows that if you saw her on the street, you might think, do I know her? Place got her start with roles in classic TV shows like MASH and All in the Family. She also wrote for MASH and The Mary Tyler Moore Show. But her breakout performance was playing the aspiring country singer Loretta Haggers on the oddball satirical soap opera Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. She earned an Emmy for that role and a Grammy nomination for an album she recorded as the Haggers character. Place also starred in dozens of films, including The Big Chill and Being John Malkovich. For her latest film, Diane, she landed the lead role. Kent Jones wrote and directed Diane specifically with Mary Kay Place in mind. And she told The Frame host John Horn how Jones first approached her.
He came up to me and said that he had seen the Francis Ford Coppola film of the John Grisham novel, The Rainmaker. And the Dot Black character that I played in that reminded him of his mother and her side of the family, the matriarchal family that she came from.
Dear Mrs. Black, on 7 prior occasions, this company has denied your claim in writing. We now deny it for the 8th and final time. You must be stupid, stupid, stupid. Sincerely, Everett Luftkin, Vice President, Claims Department.
And he said, I knew right then and there you could play my mother. And he said, I want to write a film with you starring in it based on stories that I've wanted to tell. And I said, you'll never get a dime to make this movie. I said, I would love to do it. I'm so excited that you would ever think of me for anything like this. But you won't be able to raise any money from my name, so I just need to tell you that right now. He said, oh, I'm not worried about that at all. We'll get it done somehow. So the fact that it has is a down-and-out miracle, a gift from God for sure.
So much of this story is about loss, about when people reach a certain age, it's inevitable that people start dying or getting sick or struggling with illness. I want to play a scene where your character's at the salon getting your nails done before a friend's funeral.
How's the family?
Well, my Aunt Ina is the last of the aunts and uncles, and she's got emphysema and smokes like a chimney, but she's hanging in there.
I just can't believe they all went so fast.
I lost my favorite aunt last year.
I'm sorry.
I loved her the best.
Yeah, I loved all my aunts, too.
Tell me a little bit about what you and Kent talked about what's happening in Diane's life and how she's processing it through the course of the story.
My parents had both died by the time I shot this film. I have a very close family, but a small family. My aunt and uncle had died. Both my sets of grandparents had died. I have one 100-year-old cousin, second cousin, who had her birthday January 4th. She reached 100. She's the last living elder. So I had experienced it in my own life, and Kent's mother had passed away a couple of years earlier, and all the rest of his aunts and cousins were gone. A few cousins, I think he still has. But we talked about our families like that and how it just felt so strange to not have these cousins and aunts that had occupied and been a huge part of our whole lives.
We're talking with Mary Kay Place about her film, Diane. Diane is a person whose life is defined by kindness. She is often taking food to people, helping out soup kitchens. She is somebody who feels a calling, a need to look after others. When you're thinking about what is motivating Diane, how did you come to an understanding for where charity and kindness and generosity became so important to her?
I think she's a part of the tradition of women in communities like that who are servers. They serve the community. They take care of other people. And I think they've been raised that way. I think that's a default position for them. She's also atoning in a certain way for some guilt and shame that she feels. And I think she also keeps herself very busy doing. And as the movie develops, we see her begin to develop an inner life and reflect in a journal and contemplate, perhaps, what do I want? What do I need now that my world is shrinking? And she's been busy doing and not being, and she learns how to be, to use what is almost a cliche now, but it's true.
We were talking with Glenn Close about her movie, The Wife, and we were talking about a column that was written in the LA Times by culture critic Mary McNamara, who said that finally it was about time that women who were not 30 or 40, but were older, were getting great shots at great parts. And I want to play you what Glenn Close had to say about this.
I think it's spectacular that women of my age are still having viable, exciting careers, because the irony is we only get better.
I mean, which I think is true. I mean, Glenn Close has never acted better, but I'm curious if you share that feeling.
I totally agree with Glenn. It's because of all the different venues, Netflix, Hulu, cable. Although in films, a lot of these movies don't get made anymore because there's no slot, so to speak, for them. But it's great that they then show later on Netflix or some other cable station so that a wide variety of people are able to see them. But there is a lot more for women, older women, available for us for work at this point in time. Now, not all of it is deep like The Wife or Diane, and that sort of is a, I would say, uncommercial area that is much more rare. But at the same time, there's a lot of opportunities for older women to be seen. And I think, you know, we need to be diversified in that way as we need to be diversified in all ways.
I'm going to ask you another question about that, because you started your work in the movie business and TV as a writer, and you were writing on shows when women were not writing on shows. They're maybe making material inroads today, but a couple decades ago, women didn't get those kinds of jobs. What was it like back then, and how important was it that you were in there working alongside so many men?
It was very helpful to be from Oklahoma. Because all the men that wrote those shows were from New York City, and we were just, Linda Bloodworth and I were exotic creatures. And I started out, I was certainly had been an actor all along and was taking class, but rather than be a waitress, I was in production jobs because I was also interested in writing and directing and production. And so I worked for the Tim Conway Comedy Hour. I met all these comedy writers, and then I worked for Norman Lear's company, and so I typed about 940,000 versions of various scripts, and I thought, wait a minute, the Mary Tyler Moore Show was popular, and we were all big fans, and I thought, I've got some ideas for shows like that. And by this time, I'd been in enough note sessions and director sessions where I knew what the structure was. I knew, I just learned so much. It was like graduate school. So that's when I began writing. But actually, it was the perfect time to be there because there weren't any women. And we had the Mary Tyler Moore Show and all these other shows that were about women. And these men from New York City in their 40s and 50s really didn't know anything about what it was like to be a 30-something woman starting out in a career in a television station.
Well, let's face it, Mary, you are not what I would call an experienced woman.
Mary, you have no idea how experienced or inexperienced I am. I mean, sure, true, I'm not what you'd call a wild woman, but I'm hardly innocent. I've been around. Well, all right, I might not have been around, but I've been nearby.
But they were extremely open and welcoming to us. So from my point of view, it was the perfect time to be there because we had an invitation. I mean, I had to write a spec script and they had to read it and say, yes, we like this. But I think it's much harder to break in now than it was then.
And having written and having directed, does that change you as an actor? What does it do in terms of how you perform?
Well, I acted in a MASH script that I wrote, and I thought, wait a minute, I did not connect the dots well at all in this script. So I knew I learned something about writing. I'm not that great of a writer. I really admire and respect the 1% club because it is so difficult to be a good writer. But I learned what a good script looks like and feels like. And the directing, I had great respect for the, I imagined the crew and the cast as a big circle, putting all their energy into the center to create the show. And I realized how each piece of the puzzle is crucial and we can't do it without the other one. So I had total respect for being on the set on time, you know, doing your homework, because it's so hard to do this in the first place and everybody's important.
Mary Kay Place, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It was fun.
Diane is in theaters and on demand now. And here's Mary Kay Place singing Baby Boy from her 1976 album, tonight at the Capri Lounge, Loretta Haggers. Coming up on The Frame, how Clementine Creevy of the band Cherry Glazer fights gender bias one song at a time. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. Coming up later this week, an interview with the producer who's finally getting a legendary concert film with Aretha Franklin into theaters. And we'll have a report from the set of Fresh Off the Boat as the TV series airs its 100th episode. And now, Clementine Creevy is a 22-year-old Los Angeles musician who wants to level the playing field in alternative music. She sings and plays guitar in the indie rock group Cherry Glazer. The band is named with a slight spelling alteration after a radio news anchor here in L.A. Creevy and bandmates Tabor Allen and Libby Bennett just released the album Stuffed and Ready. Frame contributor Allison Wolf was a natural to profile Creevy. Wolf is co-founder of the riot girl band Bratmobile, and she recently met up with Creevy at the musician's LA home.
Being seen as less capable has always been a major issue for me. It's this internalized thing that we all feel, and that we all see women in this way. It's forced me to want to be really, really good at my instrument. I'm Clementine Creevy, Clem from Cherry Glazer. I'm an only child. I was a lone wolf. My mom raised me as a single mom. We moved around a lot. I was born in New York, and then I went to Chicago, and then I went to LA, and then I lived in Mississippi for a few years, Chicago again, and then finally LA. My mom, she would bring me everywhere and was a creative person, and then she got married to my stepdad, who's my now adopted father, when I was 12 years old, and I settled here. So I succeeded. Growing up with a single mom, it made me be very independent. And it's shaken me up a few times because I've been like, why am I so weird? I want to go around and do things by myself all the time. But at the end of the day, I'm really grateful that she gave me those tools. I got started playing music when I was like 5. I was always singing around the house. I remember writing a song when I was 11. It was like, winter is here, and the snow is here. I used to think. Then I got a guitar for the first time when I was 10. Started really playing when I was like 11, 12. Trick or treat, dance floor, trick or treat, dance floor. I had so much encouragement from my mom. She forced me to take lessons. She was relentless about it because she knew I was good. That sounds cocky, but I thought I was good. I know in my music, there's been this through line of me growing up, and I even feel like my voice has changed from album to album, literally, because I don't think I was done with puberty when I was 15 doing the first album, and my voice is very different now. Milkshakes and cat eyes, lipstick and French fries. Turn a lot of so much, but so little. Don't make us feel belittled. So I was just really into shredding, and I would go into my garage every day after school and play guitar for hours and hours and hours. And my friend Hannah, she was a drummer, so we started jamming together, and it formed really naturally. We got our other friend involved, and then my other friend involved, and I had created this band. My first album technically is Papa Crimp, and the second one, Haxel Princess, and then Apocalyptic, and now Stuffed and Ready. I put so much pressure on myself to not be vulnerable. I wanted people to see me the way they see men. The songs that I was writing for Stuffed and Ready were kind of working through that pain of having my guard up all the time. I wanted to sort of feel with my music and talk more about those things that I kept off limits before. I can get confused about reality and social media sometimes. I can feel the weight of these people looking at me, but then I'm just like sitting alone in my room. How could I feel anxiety of people looking at me when I'm sitting alone in my room? I can sit in misery. That's not my real life. It's sort of this song about feeling like an object. Within my internet presence, me as a brand, as a commodity. Well, if you want me to be an object, you're gonna strip me bare of everything that I really am. This is what it's gonna look like. just a tree with just branches and no leaves. I tend to write a lot about power dynamics, and that includes confidence, because I think about my place in the world a lot. Men have gotten places that I want to be, and I want that same respect. I want people to see me as capable.
That was Clementine Creevy of the band Sherry Glazer. I think I'll start a band. It's going to be called Nick Roman. And that's The Frame for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.